Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our audience live here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce Elizabeth Cobb Hoffman. She is the author of American Umpire, a topic when she brought it to me, I was extremely interested in right away because it's a very, very interesting concept in foreign policy, in human history, that anybody plays this role rather than another role. So she is the Dwight E. Stanford Professor of American Foreign Relations at San Diego State University, and she's also a National Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. And I think it's thanks to them that we have the great pleasure of having her here today. Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to thank you all so much for coming here tonight and joining me, and also to thank George for his very gracious invitation, because we're here to discuss perhaps one of the most critical questions of our era, which is why the United States assumed the role of world defender, one might say, and whether we must continue this role indefinitely. Now, the conversation springs from my new book, American Umpire, but it also came out of an op-ed I wrote for the New York Times a year or so ago, in which I pointed out that a lot of people talk about getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan, but what about Japan and Germany? And essentially what I was trying to get at here was a kind of more basic conversation about the role of the United States in the world. And I think in many ways we suffer from a lack of historical self-awareness. And it's a lack of historical self-awareness that makes us a target and also obscures our choices for the future. And this is my big moment to be the cheerleader for history, because history shows us the really big patterns that help us understand our choices amid the tumult of everyday events and everyday crises. Now, when I say everyday crises, that sounds like small things, but no, not really, because in the world of foreign affairs, there are crises every day. And it's so easy to be stampeded or buffaloed if in responding to contemporary crises you don't understand the overall direction. And that's what history can give to us. Now, give an example of this confusion that we have, going right to the top here to President Obama. In his 2013 address last year, the first time he advised us to go into Syria, he said that the United States has been the chief enforcer of international law for the past 70 years. And then he said, but we are not the world's policemen. Okay, I'm confused. What is a policeman but an enforcer of law? And then at the United Nations, where he spoke not long after that, he said that the United States seeks a world order that respects state sovereignty, but in which sovereignty cannot shield a country from outside intervention. Okay, again, massive confusion here, because the whole point of sovereignty is complete authority within territorial boundaries. So in effect, what the president was really saying is that we seek a world which respects state sovereignty, but in which sovereignty is subject to external checks and balances. Now, by the way, I hope your ears are already tingling, because phrases like checks and balances are very American kinds of phrases. How does that apply to an international arena? And that's what I'm going to be explaining. Because in many ways, what he's saying is, in the same way that the federal government operates in the United States, there's a checks and balances on states, on their sovereignty, to uphold things like the Bill of Rights. Now, this kind of doublespeak isn't intentional. And when I say President Obama speaking out of both sides of his mouth, I'm not talking about just him, per se. I think it's all American presidents, many American presidents, and the American public at large, which doesn't really understand, as immodest as that say, but the structure of world affairs generally and our place in it and how that's evolved historically. And if we don't understand these things, nobody else will. Because every country is the primary producer of the scholarship about its own history. And if we don't understand our history, we certainly can't expect anyone else to. And the fact is, the U.S. does exercise a very unusual role in world affairs as the nation with the greatest and yet very limited power to determine outcomes in foreign relations, to affect how things are going to turn out. The fact is, when things go wonky, as they do all the time, people don't say, what's Mexico going to do about it? You know, what's Iran going to do? What's Russia, France? They say, what's the United States going to do about it? We say it. Others ask the same question. And the fact is that 95% of all soldiers who serve on territory other than their own, 95%, including NATO peacekeepers, UN peacekeepers, are Americans, on other people's soil, solving other people's problems, and often creating new ones along the way as well. So this raises important possibilities. Door number one, door number two, door number three. Door number one, are we the world's policemen? Another way of saying that from another perspective is, are we a bully that imposes its values on other people? Or, worse yet, are we an empire, as many people claim, that seeks to dominate the world largely for its own economic and political benefit? So that's one possibility. The other possibility, as many realists believe, is that actually the United States is the only thing that really stands between peace and Armageddon. That if we do not want the world to go into another Great Depression or another World War, that the United States, or even nuclear devastation of the planet, that the United States must stoically soldier on, doing the same role forever. And then, if that's true, the question we must ask is, for how long? At what cost? To our schools and our children and our psyche and our soldiers? Or is it possible, here's door number three, and this is what my research suggests, that the road we've been on for the last 70 years has been a necessary detour on the main path towards which history has been heading actually since 1648, and that now is the time, now is the moment for a course correction. If that's true, if I'm right, then my book challenges us to transition to the next phase of our national epic confidently, affirmatively, learning from both successes and failures. Indeed, to be objective, scholars must be as rigorous in identifying what's worked as what hasn't worked, right? Because you learn from both things. Well, now I hate to be a tease because I can't possibly answer all of these very big questions with sufficient evidence in 45 minutes. That's why you have to read my book. Every author must say this, our publishers tell us, et cetera. But anyway, no, I hope you will, what I'm advancing in American Umpire is a new interpretation, not just of American history, but of world history. So what I'm going to do is try and give you 300 years in 45 minutes, 40 minutes around there, give you time for questions. So what I want to do in today's talk are three quick things. I want to explain to you why I wrote this book. I want to say something about why I think the reigning scholarly paradigm, how we understand this, is wrong. And then I want to give you a substitute interpretation, another way for us to begin to think about our own history. And that is essentially what my explanation will try to show, is that the world has collectively devised new norms, new ways of thinking over the past 400 years, and that under the press of catastrophic events in the 1940s, the United States reversed its very long-standing policy of political and military non-engagement with the rest of the world and adopted a function that was akin to, but not completely identical with, one that it was used to playing. Used to playing among its own states, a role of umpire to compel acquiescence between squabbling states in moments of crisis. And at that time in 1947, when we sort of half backed into, half were pulled into, half fell into, half volunteered for this role, we were the only nation with the relevant experience and track record and requisite capacity to play a very difficult, very contentious role. So why did I write this book? Well, it actually started here in San Francisco. I was interviewing for a fellowship when I was going to go into graduate school, and it was a scholarship, and I wanted to go into diplomatic history, what was then called diplomatic history, and I was here in San Francisco interviewing for this fellowship. And I was very excited, and I go into the room, I sit there before this panel of experts, and the first man says, now, tell us why you want to enter a dying field. I did not know it was dying until he told me, but I bunted quickly and I said, because how can we let that die? It's too important. But I learned he was right, and I think that what had happened in that field is that young scholars were repelled by a field, which first of all wasn't social history, and this was a period of time where you could start writing about sex and class and race and things that were kind of racier and fun and interesting. But I think also that many young scholars were perhaps repelled by a subject in which the answer to every question was pretty much always the same. The United States messed up. And so for whatever reason, scholars left this field and it got turned over to political scientists, largely, whose understanding of history, of course, is not as deep. It's not their field. And also scholars, those historians who stayed in the field, were those who tended to advance a similar kind of interpretation again and again, which is that most of U.S. history was about empire and imperialism, that the U.S. was an empire, is an empire, an imperialist country. But I think that term, and why I wrote the book, is because I've over the years come to believe more and more deeply, based on evidence, that this is a misleading term and it's an incorrect diagnosis. And we all know that the only thing worse than no diagnosis is a misdiagnosis. Because a misdiagnosis leads to wrong prescriptions and sometimes fatal consequences. And what happens is it takes our eyes off the real problem and diverts them to a false problem. And of course, for those who think the U.S. is an empire, groups like Al-Qaeda, what's the prescription? Death to the empire. Doesn't give us any way to really go forward. So who says that the United States is an empire? And I just always like to run through a few titles because every now and again I think maybe I'm exaggerating this. But I know I'm not. It's very hard to even read a doctoral dissertation these days without coming across empire in the first paragraph or two. One of the most well-known is a book by Chalmers Johnson called Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire. Neil Ferguson, a Harvard professor who wrote Colossus, The Rise and Fall of the American Empire. Richard Immerman from Temple University, Empire for Liberty, A History of American Imperialism. From Benjamin Franklin to Paul Wolfowitz. Among Empires, Charles Mayer from Harvard University, American Empire, Among Empires, American Ascendancy and Its Predecessors, Andrew Bacevich, American Empire, here's the granddaddy of them all, William Appleman Williams, Empire is a Way of Life. Now, by the way, this is the 50th anniversary edition, too, by the way, in case you haven't gotten yours yet. I like this very simply titled one, Empire, Michael Hart and Antonio Negri. Another more lighthearted, irresistible empire. America's advance through 20th century Europe. By the way, this author, and there's another one who says that they talk not about the Monroe Doctrine, but the Marilyn Monroe Doctrine, because his book features a pretty woman on top of a Boeing jet. There's The Empire Trap by Noel Maurer, also of Harvard, Rise and Fall of U.S. Intervention. In Praise of Empires, Deepak Lal from UCLA. Now, by the way, not everybody who says the U.S. is an empire is critical of that. Some of them, like Neil Ferguson, just wishes we'd do it better, like the Brits. Deepak Lal also similarly believes empires have an important role to play. We should just do it better. Then there's, of course, the Empire Trilogy, which is by Chalmers Johnson. Sometimes it makes me feel like I'm arguing against Lord of the Rings or something. It's pretty out there. So what do these books say? And I want to give you just a teeny tiny peek into them. I'm sure some of you have read some of these, so it won't be terribly unfamiliar, but some might not have. Chalmers Johnson, for example, says the American bases, military bases abroad are, quote, striking evidence, for those who care to look, of an imperial project that the Cold War obscured. Andrew Bacevich, who also considers himself a conservative, some people think he's so far on the right that he's on the left. But nonetheless, he says the purpose of the Iraq War was it was a war for the imperium, to expand an American imperium. By the way, so on the true left, World Socialist Web says Iraq was a predatory imperialist war. It was carried out as a part of a long-range strategy for reorganizing the Middle East to secure American interests. Tariq Ali, another Brit who writes for the New Left Review, he says, when people tell me the American empire is weakening, I say, don't underestimate it. Europe and the Middle East fall into line whenever the United States says this has to be done and that has to be done. So the only really sovereign nation today is the imperial nation. Now, you might all think, oh, well, this is, you know, how many imperialists can you get on the head of a pin? You know, these are academics with their academic arguments, right? And so what's that matter? But it does matter because people read this. This is what we tell people about ourselves. Tamerlane Tsarnaev, who, of course, masterminded and carried out the second Boston Massacre at the marathon a couple of years ago. He went around and talked to his neighbors ahead of time about the American Empire and how terrible it was. So these things percolate into the soil of the world. Now, by the way, President Obama recently tried to counter this in his speech to the UN in 2013, and he said, quote, "The notion of an American empire isn't borne out by America's current policy. We seek a world where nations do not covet the land or resources of other nations." Now, about half an hour later on Democracy Now!'s radio show, this was translated as, I'm quoting again now, Obama, quote, basically came out and said, "The United States is an imperialist nation, and we are going to do whatever we need to conquer areas to take resources from the world," unquote. So I don't know how you get it into here and get it out the other side and of your head and translate it this way, but this is a reigning paradigm that is so strong that when people put on their glasses, it's what they see. And I think it's time for us to really start looking carefully at this. Because we have this tendency to take words and use them very casually without really defining them. And words have true consequences. And we can't use the same word for multiple applications if it doesn't all mean the same thing. So let me tell you a little bit about how I think many serious scholars, and I really, people I admire, my friends, in fact, in the history profession, often talk about this and why they think the U.S. is an empire. And there are three basic reasons that I plan to dismantle here for you tonight. And the first of these has to do with the U.S. expansion across the West. You know, here was the U.S. being an empire, American expansion across the West. The second, which we'll talk about in a moment, is the fact the U.S. has military bases all over the world. What else? What other proof do you need to have? And that coincided with the spread of American values. So therefore, these things explain each other. That's the second argument. The third argument is that look around us at the wealth that the United States has. How else can we explain U.S. economic prominence if not by saying it really came at the expense of others? So to begin with, let's look at this, first of all, the expansion argument. And again, if you say empire, any word, you must use it consistently in the same way to have any scholarly rigor at all. You can't say, here's an orange, but I'm going to call an apple an orange. And I'm going to call an enchilada an orange. And I'm going to call my car an orange, right? It has to be the same all along. So I like to talk about Latin America, because 19th century expansion was brutal, absolutely brutal process. And indigenous peoples all around the world got it in the neck. It was a terrible, terrible set of events. But that was true really throughout the globe. I like to take the example of Chile, which we don't normally go around talking about as an empire. We know Chile is a nation, like the United States is a nation. Chile had about half the territory when it was first formed that it has now. How did it get the rest? Well, oops, at the expense of Bolivia and Peru. Fought a war against them, the War of the Pacific in the 1870s. Then it turned its attention southward to areas that the Spanish had never conquered, the areas of the Mapuche people, and conquered all of that area to the south as well. By the way, other nation states did it too, and if you look at a map of Latin America from this period of time, such as I'm showing our audience here in San Francisco, it's a crazy quilt of competing claims to borders. And this is what has happened in many post-colonial environments where, you know, the empire leaves and people start duking it out. In fact, there were 21 border wars in Latin America after the withdrawal of the Spanish, very similar to the U.S.-Mexican War, which is another thing that's also often brought out as an example of the U.S. as an empire. Well, if it's an empire for that reason, then so is Chile, and so is Brazil, and so is Argentina. Argentina also expanded southward at the expense of indigenous peoples as well, just as the United States did, just as brutally. Certainly nothing that we would applaud today. So if you look at comparisons and you try to apply terms evenly and consistently, then you cannot call the United States an empire for doing basically what most of the Latin American countries did, as well as Australia, as well as Canada, which we don't normally talk about as an empire. Now, the second reason that people often talk about the U.S. as an empire is because of its bases all over the world. And we do have some, you know, different numbers shout them out if you want. Have you heard the number 800 bases around the world? 850 bases. And by the way, that's all true. It's also important to understand that some of these bases will have 30,000 soldiers affiliated with them, and some have enough to fill possibly a minivan. So a lot of these bases are extraordinarily tiny. I think there are 8 in Uruguay, for example. So this number 850 can be a little bit confusing. But in any case, empires, when they put a base, they don't leave if you ask them to leave. And the United States has, for example, in this particular depiction, the U.S. Air Force was in France. One of the first places that kicked us out was France, our oldest ally. In 1967, they said, Yankee, go home. And the U.S. withdrew and closed down its air bases in France and left. Of course, the same is true in the Philippines as well and other places where the United States has been asked to leave. So military bases, you can't really use the term empire because you couldn't ask Rome to go home if you felt like it. These are on contractual bases. Now, the other reason that people often will say the U.S. is an empire is because of its economy. And I always like to point out that the U.S. had the world's largest economy in what year? 1890. 25 years before World War I. 25 years before the United States sent anybody abroad. So this is also is not a good way to explain how the U.S. is an empire, because U.S. economic prowess comes from other things, has a lot of totally different explanations that have to do with the 19th century, immigration and all kinds of reasons. And yet, it's true. The United States is the world's largest interventionist nation. So don't we keep, you know, kind of keep coming back to that in our mind and say, yes, but explain to me why it is that this, you know, always the United States is asked to or that does volunteer to stand up. And how do we explain the coincidence of American interventionism and the spread of American values all around the world, other than using a counterfactual explanation like that the U.S. is an empire? Now, I say counterfactual because if the idea of the United States was to rob others of their autonomy and resources, well, then we're the weirdest empire in the world, because the exact opposite has happened. The number of sovereign countries has roughly quadrupled from around 50 at the start of the 20th century to around 200 today. And world wealth has gone up tremendously, world economic development. So the same period of time that the United States was most powerful happens to also be the same period of time in which the number of countries has, you know, just simply mushroomed, and which more wealth has been created than at any other time in human history. So how do we explain it? Well, the explanation for the spread of American values is that they are not American. In fact, if we look at world history, what we can see is that throughout world history, anything that really worked, any new technique of production or governance, generally has spread spontaneously from its point of origin outward without any coercion at all. 20 years ago, if someone had said to us all, you will all have computers in your pockets in 20 years, we would have thought, oh my God, how am I going to get on my chair? You know, how could you carry a computer around? And yet we all have these now. And the fact is that, you know, Apple does not have to coerce anybody to buy the iPhone. People line up to buy it, from Silicon Valley to Siberia. And I think in some ways what we can see, what world history shows, is that a similar epical transition has happened throughout the period of time that we're very familiar with in this modern world period, where other kinds of innovations have spread outward in the same way that Apple iPhones have, in the same way that wheat did. In the Neolithic, the transition from the Neolithic to the Paleolithic was the transition from hunting and gathering to farming. Nobody had to force farming down anybody's throats. It spread outward from Mesopotamia and Mesoamerica more or less spontaneously. The same was true of the Industrial Revolution. You don't have to go around making other people industrialize. They just try to do it as quickly as they possibly can. And the same thing happened with the spread of what we tend to call American values, and I think rather incorrectly, although the United States did apply some of these values and some of these techniques earlier than some other societies. But, for example, when the Latin American countries formed after, as a part of the Napoleonic Wars, they all declared republics. They all said, we want that. Now, was it because the United States had military bases or economic prowess? Nothing. They did it because they thought, this is something we can borrow, this is something we can use, we'll make it ours. In fact, it is ours. And, of course, France even earlier. And I think that sometimes when we talk about American values forcing them down other people's throats, we do a great disservice to other people because we take ownership of things that are not properly ours, which also gives us a big stake in defending them that actually others should be sharing as well. Now, by the way, however, the United States certainly has had a role, and I think that one of the roles it's played is simply by showing that certain practices worked, certain practices that people had thought about for multiple generations. For example, that you could have a chief executive who would retire after his or maybe in the future her term, that you could also create a durable peace amongst competing nations, competing states, as it applies to the American situation, and that you could have open commerce across borders. Those were radical innovations, but as soon as they occurred, people went, wow, that's kind of like cool. That's amazing you could do that. One of my favorite people in history is François Barbet-Marbois, who was probably one of the most astute observers of American society before de Tocqueville, who most people are more familiar with. And he said the government of the United States has no model in ancient or modern times. He had been France's first representative to the United States at the time of the Revolution, and he came back 30, 40 years later, and he said, I saw James Monroe walking down the street. He thought that was just such a tremendous thing. And so in a way, what the United States did was show that certain values that people had talked about, that they could be implemented. In the same way that Magellan sailed around the world and showed that it was round, but he didn't make it round. He just proved it because it could be circumnavigated. So what are the roles, what are the new norms that I think have taken hold, the United States has been a part of, but others have been too. And the rules of the game in the modern world, I think I boil down to three modern values: access, arbitration, and transparency. And these are the notions, essentially, that certain things work. Sort of like farming, it works. Industrialization, that's good. And so these are different values that the United States has been a part of promoting, but mostly because of its behavior, even though it's not perfectly consistent by any means. The other major rule that's changed world history, and again precedes the United States by quite a bit, is that nations replaced empires. Empires are gone. They're goners. The United States is not an empire, partly because empires were ruled illegal in 1960, the UN actually. But beginning with the Treaty of Westphalia, 1648, coming up to the breakup of the Soviet Union, we really see the end of empires. And it's partly because of these values of access, arbitration, and transparency. Now, I'd like to talk them all about all three very briefly. Access is essentially political and economic access, and Adam Smith was one of the first people to really kind of chart, right, why the free market worked. It's not a moral question, it's a practical question. It seems to work better. More wealth gets generated. Well, and of course, the same is true of political systems. Systems that are open, I don't know why, but they seem to work better than closed systems. That has a political application and an economic one. I always like to point to this man, one of my favorites, Deng Xiaoping. We don't normally think of as a great Democrat, and he wasn't. But he believed that open access to markets was going to work better for the Chinese. Now, did the Chinese do this because America made them? Because they lost the Cold War? Because we put immense pressure on them? No. They said, you know what? We see a lot of our people falling through the cracks. We need to change our system for our reasons. You know, that looks good. That looks like a better system than the one we got going. So access has turned out to be a value that has caught on. The other one is arbitration. Now, arbitration replaced the older notion that war is actually the best way to get ahead. For most of human history, the idea was that you got ahead by taking other people's stuff. You know, if you could steal your neighbor's stuff, bingo, you were golden, right? Maybe even had taken their treasury. But what has happened over a period of years, and begins really, we see this transition with the Peace of Westphalia of 1648, where nations began to come together and say, let's arbitrate our differences. That might actually work out better for us. And this begins the process of also empires folding up, because this brought to the end the Wars of the Reformation and the conflict over the Papal Empire. Now, the pinnacle of arbitration, of course, comes with the formation of the United Nations in 1945, again, here in your beautiful city in San Francisco. But there was a parallel domestically for the United States in the Constitutional Convention of 1787, because when the nation first formed, a lot of the founders said, you know, what's going to happen? Eventually, those New Yorkers, they're going to deck the folks in Vermont. And in fact, they were poised to do so. There were trade wars back and forth, tariffs slapping on each other back and forth. And so they formed the they brought the Constitutional Congress together to try to create a durable peace among states. And by the way, the word Congress, we think of that as to describe domestic parliaments, right? But it's not. The original meaning of Congress was when you brought together foreign entities. So you had the Congresses would meet, foreign Congresses. Why do we use that word here in the United States? Because we had states. And so you brought these states together to kind of create a mechanism of arbitration. And that's what happened in the United States. Now, the third value is transparency, which serves, in many ways, both access and arbitration. You're pretty hard to have without transparency. I always like to point to Mikhail Gorbachev as an example of a world leader who decided that transparency was going to work out better for him. It was going to work out better for their country. And so glasnost, of course, was one of the policies of Gorbachev. So when we look at these quote-unquote American values, we can see these are values that percolate, have roots in other parts of the world, have taken, and where they didn't have roots, they've taken seed and rooted in other parts of the world. Yet, it still doesn't explain American interventionism. All right, American values, quote-unquote, are not really American values. They've spread everywhere. We're a big part of that, but others are too. Why? How do we explain American interventionism? And this is where I go back to the American umpire. And it's interesting that the Federalists, you know, those folks who were the great advocates of the U.S. Constitution, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, when they tried to justify why we should have a Constitution, they used that word. They said umpire. We need to have an umpire to compel acquiescence. We need something above the states so that we can keep peace amongst them. John Jay said, in disputes between the states, quote, the umpire would decide between them to compel acquiescence. Alexander Hamilton wrote that the federal government would be, quote, an umpire or common judge to interpose between the contending parties, because the received wisdom is that they would shortly, you know, fall out with each other. James Madison said, quote, what better umpires could be desired than representatives in Congress? And so the Federalists created this umpire to preside above the states, to provide a kind of a place where states could, could form. And the idea here wasn't that the umpire would ever take the place of the states. That's why it didn't become an empire. The idea was to allow more states to come on board. 13 states ultimately became 50 states. And no state was allowed to aggrandize territorially at the expense of any other. No state was allowed to seize the resources of any other. Instead, they came together under a single government. And the federal government intervened very, very sparingly because it's dangerous out there. But the federal government did intervene in the nullification crisis and the Whiskey Rebellion of 1794, the Civil War, of course, began in 1861, the Little Rock integration crisis of 1957, with the understanding that it is a difficult world, and intervention can be very, very dicey. Now, today in the world at large, the United States, I think, is backed into, in a very funky way, a similar sort of role, partly because in the United Nations, we see a similar arrangement where states have equality. No state is allowed to aggrandize at the expense of anybody else, and yet the UN has no army or navy, and its peacekeepers arrive when? After a peace treaty is signed. That's the way peacekeeping is set up. Whoa, that's a big help, right? It is a big help, but it's not all that's needed. So my book posits that as a result of the Cold War, the U.S. gravitated towards this role, and it facilitated a world order based on a very similar kind of arrangement where the idea is that states should be equal, there needs to be something above them. Of course, it shouldn't be the United States, but there was no one else playing that role, and the U.S. was encouraged to do so. So, by the way, this book understands, it takes into account, that the United States made many tragic decisions along the way, and in its own early history, conducted genocidal campaigns against Native Americans, that it colonized the Philippines in 1898. There was a tragic intervention in Vietnam. All of that is very important, and it's very consistent, nonetheless, with this interpretation. And it acknowledges that intervention is dangerous, whether and controversial, and can have disastrous results, whether you do it in South Korea or South Carolina. So what have been the consequences overall, though? However, for the world in toto, I think the United States has been sometimes made really good decisions, other times made terribly poor ones. It held the line in West Berlin faithfully. faithfully for decade upon decade until finally West and East Berlin were reunited. It held a very similar looking line in South Vietnam, similar to the line in South Korea, and it turned out disastrously. It was a terrible tragedy. The United States has, however, there has been a tremendous, the result of this is that the world experienced an economic golden age. Back up here for a second, I overshot my slide presentation here. World economists talk about the economic golden age from 1950 to 1975, the world's most productive period in all world history. The second golden age was the 25 years that came after that. And also, violence between states. I'm not talking about violence in states, but violence between states has declined in every decade since 1947. States have become more and more peaceful, less and less inclined to attack one another. It's just happened. So those are the results for the world. What have been the results for the United States? Well, as this slide suggests, the United States has gotten to the point where we provide much of the world's defense. Our best allies spend 1, maybe 2% of their GDP on defense. The United States commonly spends 4 to 5%. 80 to 90% of our defense budget goes to the protection of shores other than the United States. The result in many countries around the world, which get to enjoy this peace, students go to university for free in places like Ireland and Finland and Germany and France. In the United States, 60% of our students graduate heavily in debt, debt that they will probably take with them throughout their lifetimes. The United States was first in per capita income in 1950. In 1950, it is 17th today. The United States is 50th in life expectancy. Our muscles bulge while other people's muscles atrophy. We have about 20 aircraft carriers for everybody else's one aircraft carrier. Our military expenses far outclass everybody else's, and as I said, our life expectancy is 50th in the world. Others depend and over-depend upon us. The Economist had a cartoon recently which showed David Cameron saying, "Our position on defense has not changed. We're hanging on to Uncle Sam's tailcoats." The United States has had a structural trade deficit since 1971, and we've been a debtor country since 1985. Our trade imbalance was $40 billion a year in 1992. It is $40 billion a month today. Now, crazy thing is, we remain a vibrant, prosperous, creative country for all that, but understanding that the role we're playing is one of umpire, which others can play, not empire, which makes it sound like this is all in our economic interest and we must never let go or we'll stop, you know, being the wealthy country we are. Understanding that can help us get a grip on where we might want to consider going. Former Canadian Defense Minister Peter McKay has called for allies to help share the burden. Well, I think we need to hear more. And I think we need to do more to create the expectation amongst ourselves and amongst others that it's time for others to step behind the plate. Because the most stable world system is one that everyone wants and benefits and most will defend with their lives if they have to. Realists are unrealistic in assuming that America can or should do it all. Umpires, let's face it, have you ever watched Little League? I've seen a lot of it. Umpires make mistakes. They are never entirely neutral. Their field of vision is imperfect and they cannot win. But no one wants to play the game without them. Understanding the need for umpires for sustainable, workable mechanisms of global enforcement allows us to have better conversations around the world about how to make this happen. Because good leaders develop new leaders. Placing responsibility squarely on Europe and other regions that benefit just as much as we do from a peaceful world is not a matter of cowardice. It's a measure of our courage. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that they're listening to Elizabeth Copps Hoffman, the author of American Umpire at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, who would like to ask the first question.
We're such a young nation, I don't think we're really qualified to be anything other than an umpire. We don't have that ability. We don't know the sophistication of other cultures because we're a fresh culture in our own. We don't even know our level of sophistication. I would like to hear your comments on that.
Well, I think you're correct. I don't think there's any society that is, you know, either sophisticated, old enough, whatever, to know how to make all the choices for others. I don't think the United States generally tries. But I think that what happens is when we something comes up, let's take ISIS, which, of course, is on everyone's mind now, the question becomes, oh, my gosh, we have got to do something. There's a problem. Oh, there's a problem. That means we must put on our Captain America cape and go try to solve it. And part of this, by the way, is because, you know, everybody is concerned. And I read The Economist. I know some of you must as well. And I open up The Economist, and it's what America still owes the world, you know, what America needs to do today, why America shouldn't try to look weak. And they're like, wow, what about you guys? I was talking with a German scholar the other day who said, well, Germany learned that it was more profitable and actually more moral, too, to polish our BMWs rather than our jackboots. But this person also said, well, we don't want the U.S. to be an XXL Sweden. I'm like, well, I don't know. Sweden looks pretty good. So I think you're right. Nobody can say I can figure this all out. But the problem is there are real reasons why people look for guidance in the world. The United States can do a lot, has done a lot. I think the world is largely much more prosperous and much safer because we've played this role. But we've also made some terrible mistakes. Anybody would playing this role. That's why the world as a whole needs to take up this burden.
It's been said that the trouble with referees is they don't care who wins. Excellent talk. I'd be curious to know what you think of confessions of an economic hitman in America's economic empire, which you sort of didn't really address. But I think the most critical issue facing us is the abuse of power. How, at a time of accelerating change and greater concentration of power, how do we give individuals, institutions, business, and government enough power to be effective and not enough to be corrupted?
Well, that's like 10 questions, but the values, we have these processes that do work for us. I know this sounds a little off topic, but sometimes people will say to me, because I do write a lot in public, and they'll say, but can we trust China to be a good actor? I always say, you know what? We don't have to trust China. We have to trust the process, all right? The process of access, arbitration, and transparency that have moved our world largely in better directions. So you talk about problems of corruption, for example. Transparency works for us. Does that mean we're always transparent? Heck no. The law is interesting because law tells us what people think ought to happen. Does it always happen? I have friends here in the audience, lawyers, who know that the law gets broken a lot, but you have the law because it gives you guidance and it pushes you in a better direction. So I think in our world, arbitration, that transparency, those when we hold ourselves to those values, you know, it moves us forward.
So the with the U.S.'s role as empire, how do you determine which conflicts you get involved in and how you get involved in them? For example, how would you, which are some of the conflicts that we have gotten into that you think we should not have in a role as empire? What are some of those that we did not get involved in you think we should have? And can those only be determined through hindsight?
That's a very good question, although I think you used the E word with empire, and I would only tolerate at this moment the umpire world, although we could talk about the U.S. economic empire, if you will, later. I know I didn't get to that part of the other question. I think that playing umpire is just so dicey, and it's so difficult. And one of the good things about domestically, as we all know, it's very dicey whenever the federal government gets involved in state business. The states get just totally their knickers in a twist about this. And it's understandable because sovereignty is about autonomy. And people want to be autonomous. I think that wrote recently in Reuters that I think that getting involved in the ISIS crisis, is a very big mistake. Why? Because it's about wars of religion. And there are things that you cannot do for other people. You really cannot sort out domestic problems and civil conflicts of that sort. Gosh, you know how long the Wars of the Reformation went on, where people like gouged out each other's eyes, burned neighbors at the stake, ran people through the mill pond? It went on for 150 years until people finally got so sick and tired of watching blood roll down the street that they got together in Congress and figured out some process of arbitration and keeping the peace. So I think there are any number of crises, but I think you're absolutely right. It is, a lot of it is hindsight. And that's why I, as a historian, always feel very humble about, you know, judging, because I do understand that our, you know, we have men of goodwill. I say men because our presidents have all been men up to this point. So I think people of goodwill have been in our State Department, in our federal government, and have tried to make the best choices, and have sometimes, like, really completely blown it. Because hindsight is sometimes the only way you can figure that out. I always say to people, do you realize there were 5 Vietnam presidents? One from Massachusetts, one from Missouri, one from Kansas, one from California. They're all over the map. They're Republicans, they're Democrats. But they all follow the same policy, which was the Truman Doctrine. Because all of U.S. history can, from a foreign policy perspective, can be broken into two. Only two. Two periods. 150 years where we followed a policy of deep commercial engagement, but neutrality on political issues and military issues, except in moments of crisis when we did have a lot, arrangements with other countries. And then this last 70 years, which have been the Truman Doctrine. And I just think it's really tough. The United States committed itself to defend other free countries, as it was put at the time, from internal subversion or outside pressure. Boy, that pretty much covers the waterfront, doesn't it? And, of course, the original target was communism, but now it's like pretty much everything. So I think that we need to really reassess that basic doctrine, that maybe it is time for the third period of American history, or at least it's time for a conversation about it.
My name is Michael Burkett. I'm a freelance journalist, and one of the questions that I've always had is the U.S. Constitution is, I believe, the oldest document governing a single nation in the history of the world so far. And Abraham Lincoln kind of stretched it a little bit with the Civil War, and you see that in the film with that was just done, Lincoln. He talks about that. In my mind, as the U.S. is umpire, that document seems to speak more to the world, because I've watched attorneys. My father, who was also an attorney, wrote the fifth constitution, helped write the fifth constitution for the state of South Carolina. And almost every constitutional government's document that I've watched throughout history has been rewritten in less time than the U.S. Constitution. And that document can be changed. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you hate to change the familiar, don't you? If it's working, if it ain't broken, don't fix it. On the other hand, some people say government is broken, so that leads to calls to fix it, certainly. It's the oldest written constitution. The British, of course, would remind us, as they ought to, that theirs is a far older constitution, but there is the that represents the compilation of all their laws. In the case of the United States, obviously, this is a question of debate. I don't think that that actually happens to be our problem in foreign affairs, by the way. I think that many people really do admire the fact that the United States Constitution remains relevant and remains largely functional, although there's been an accretion of a lot of laws to it that certainly have impacted it. It's always been open to judicial interpretation. Of course, that goes back also to very early founding fathers. And there was a great debate amongst the founding fathers, Jefferson and Hamilton. George, didn't tell you I'm also a novelist. I have a novel called Broken Promises, a novel of the Civil War. And my second novel, which I'm working on now, is about Alexander Hamilton. And Hamilton and Jefferson, oh my God, these, you know, and of course, Hamilton was killed by the sitting vice president, indicted in 2 states. Thank you very much. In any case, they disagreed on the question of how far did federal sovereignty extend, and that's why Lincoln was a questionable whether or not the federal government could compel states to stay in this voluntary union. Okay, wrap your head around that one. That's why it was so complicated. So I think for the United States, yes, obviously constitutional amendment is an important part of, you know, going forward if people feel that that is useful, but it is also important to understand how, I think, how admired it is in the 19th century, and my book, you know, starts with the founding fathers and works up, you know, all the way through to the present. But one thing I discovered, which I didn't know much about when I was writing this, was all of the discussion in the mid-19th century about creating a United States of Europe. Because look at that U.S. Constitution thing. That's kind of working out pretty well. And Victor Hugo and others said, you know, the day is going to come, mark my words, where France and Germany and Britain are going to sit down at a table and pass laws like the United States does. And, of course, today we have the European Union, so which is a structured differently from the United States. But that idea that maybe people can sit in a room like we're sitting here tonight, and they will disagree with each other very bitterly sometimes, but maybe they can create a durable peace among states. Today, we take it as granted that our neighbors are going to be possibly even good friends of ours, right? We'll have them over for casseroles. They'll watch our dog when we go away. Canada's not going to try and rip us off. That, to us, seems so self-evident that we lose sight of the fact that this is actually a very new development in world history for which the United States actually... We can sometimes look ourselves in the mirror and say, wow, we are amongst the first to do that. That's great. Didn't always work out for us. Let's talk about the Civil War next time. But the fact is that was a real accomplishment. I think we have one other question right here.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had any ideas about how to shift the amount of money we spend militarily around the world to our own interests and have other nations step up if that's what's needed.
Well, that's a very, very good question. I'm actually working on a documentary right now which is trying to ask this very question. People have different answers. Some people say, oh my gosh, if you do that, the world will fall apart. You know, I've spoken with some former secretaries of state, for example, who say this. Other people say, you know what? If the Europeans don't invest in their defense, maybe it's because they don't feel they need to, not only because the U.S. will be there to pick up the problem, you know, anything happens, but because they're actually pretty secure. So some other people would say, listen, we need to step back. A very good book recently by Barry Posen of MIT called Restraint, and he says, you know what, we ought to be capping it. We ought to cap our defense spending and say, we'll figure it out on that budget, and we'll even do a little bit more than all the NATO partners who never actually do this much do. We'll make it 2.5% instead of the 2% cap, which nobody else ever meets. So some people say that to get other people to step up, you have to step back. And other people say that's too scary. So this is a conversation we need to have, but that's certainly one way. I think as long as we're willing to pay ad infinitum, then probably people will be happy to let us do that.
Well, here I am first. What would two or three of your greatest worries be in terms of our country as it moves forward and we deal with this role between umpire, empire, and domestic needs and international demands, et cetera? You know, from your research, there's a saying, what keeps you awake at night in terms of worries about the future of our country?
Well, don't they say about, I don't know, insanity or alcoholism or something, that the definition of crazy is to do the same thing again and again, expect a different result. So I think that in our wars of the last decade or so, we've seen that how well it works out to intervene in other people's religious problems, how well it works out to try and convince countries which have a lot of internal strife how to manage their affairs. I don't think it's worked out well for us or for them. I think it was well-intended. I don't think it was a war for the Imperium or that it was a war about securing oil, of which we have, by the way, more than most people in the world. So I don't think it was about economic empire. I think it was about an attempt to play this role well, and we didn't, and we haven't. So my concern is that we will continue to send troops after ISIS and the next ISIS and the next ISIS without really considering whether or not we can really do that. So I think rather than our energy being on trying to see the next crisis down the road, it should really be on trying to figure out what is the appropriate role in a world that is, thank goodness, what we wanted it to be, a world of sovereign nation states. The United States gave away so much power after World War II. Do you realize that? What the United States could have done, what it chose not to do, to encourage the formation of the European Union, which now, by the way, is bigger than us economically, to encourage the development of the United Nations, where even the tiniest, most annoying states in the whole world get an equal vote. They don't have equal power. Not everybody in this room has the same income level. Not everybody in this room has the same you know, abilities, et cetera, the list goes on. But the principle of juridical equality was established, and that's a very important principle. So I think that we need to be thinking about that principle in terms of how to go forward. So that keeps me awake at night, and it saddens my heart to see our young men and women out there, you know, losing their lives. It saddens my heart as a professor to see my students with $60,000 in debt, $70,000 in debt. You know, it just really does. I think it's a terrible thing, and we should be thinking about them when we make these choices.
Yeah, hi. If I may look at this from an economic standpoint, you mentioned the second stage of the golden age, which was from 50 to 75. Coincidentally, in 50, right about the time right after the war, the countries adopted the U.S. dollar and the U.S. dollar as the international currency, and it went on the gold standard. And again, by coincidence, right towards the early 70s was when the U.S. went off the gold standard. And right about the 90s was when we started to export our inflation. That was when the Clinton era opened up the U.S. markets to international competition. And so I'm just curious as to what your thoughts might be on this matter as to how it plays into, as long as all the commodities today, including oil, of course, is all dollar denominated, I would say that, yes, we are continuing to, whether you call it umpire or empire, it is all economic driven. Because some will also argue that the war in Iraq was really a battle between the dollar and the euro, and it was Chirac's dream to see the euro as the international currency rather than continuing to see the dollar as the international currency, because Iraq was supposedly getting ready to switch to the euro-denominated oil that Venezuela had already done, and was to basically stem that tide. I'm just curious to know.
Well,
what
I'm not familiar with this argument that it was all about the euro. I heard that it was all about oil. I think that there has been some conversation that, again, I'm not an economist, so I'm not going to be able to give you as precise an answer as you deserve. But I think there has been some question about whether or not the world might go on a different denomination, and that even the Chinese are resistant to that idea, partly because economic markets like stability and sameness. And so even if whether the dollar goes up or down, it provides a kind of barometer for people in terms of figuring out values. So whether it's cowrie shells or dollars may not make that big a difference. Some people think that the U.S. has an actual economic advantage in this respect. There's some economist, Daniel Dresner, for example, of Tufts, argues that actually economic primacy doesn't pay as much as you think. That's not as valuable to the U.S. And if you look at what's happened to the U.S. economy, boy, if that's what's going to make us wealthy, I think it was a bad strategy because our economic, you know, position has declined relatively. So that's all I could say about that. I think we have one. I don't even know if we have one question, George. We have one. One last question?
Yeah. No, there's time for maybe two more. But
okay.
One other issue on that economic thing. That argument was presented about the euro, but the euro was you know, I mean, people talked about that, but the euro was just getting started. It didn't have anywhere near the stability, and so people were arguing about that, like Chirac. But it that was not a major influence on that war at all. It was way too early for people to think about that.
Well, that was his attempt to launch.
It's his attempt, yes, exactly.
Which didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. It was, yeah. Right. I just think it's there are a lot of arguments about what the causes of that war are, and that was certainly talked about, but it was way too early a stage for that to be a major factor. That's all I wanted to throw.
Yeah, definitions are important. Would you tell me how you separate the use of the word religion, pointing out that that's been our mistake to not recognize them, when states, ideas driven by people who do murderous acts that are clearly immoral and on the goal of creating an empire. How do you separate those two?
Well, sometimes people think that power and violence are always for one thing, and they're not. States, as we know, the whole point of a state, right, as Thomas Hobbes said, is the states have monopolies on violence. Are all states out to murder their citizens? No. But states do use violence. It is a tool of states, as is currency, as are street lamps, to organize societies and to facilitate traffic, if you will. And so sometimes that violence gets used appropriately, and sometimes it's abused. I don't think that we define whether a state is an empire or an umpire or merely just a little tiny piddling nation state like, I don't know, you name one. I don't want to name one because I said piddling, and that'll make it sound like I'm putting somebody down, and I'm not. But the point is that states and empires and umpires use violence, and sometimes they use it very poorly, and sometimes we would say they use it well, in the sense that sometimes coercion is necessary in human affairs, sad as that may be. And that's certainly the reason why our Constitution federal government was signed, because of the understanding that some degree of coercion would always be necessary. And that's really what the Civil War was about. The United States finally pulled out its hammer and said, okay, on this issue, the federal government will reign supreme. And what followed was a terribly bloody war. Was that the right choice? Should Abraham Lincoln have done that? Should the states, which were sovereign states, have been allowed to go their own way? Well, that's the kind of, now we really are playing Monday morning quarterbacking here. But, you know, some people would argue yes. But the point is that nation states, all nation states, in fact, are coercive. I don't know, ask the Catalonians, right? And this is one reason why nationalism is so divisive. Because tomorrow we could define the Commonwealth Club as its own little state here in San Francisco, or at least vis-a-vis, I don't know, Oakland or something. And that tends to beget violence.
The Civil War is still going on. They just don't use guns in America.
I think we have plenty of guns in America, but okay.
They're not being used. It's still going on.
There's time for just one more question.
Hi. I wanted to play devil's advocate, and I wonder if you could respond to those who would say that if the U.S. steps aside, that it would create an enormous vacuum for organizations like the Islamic State, Russia, or China. So what would you say to that?
And such a good question, and such an honest and important question to ask. One thing to remember historically is the reason why the U.S. assumed this role is because Europe was completely physically devastated, as was Japan, as was China, as was much of Asia. The British, we often forget, were on wartime rations of meat and cheese and butter until the 1950s, the mid-1950s. So the United States was the only country, the last man standing, and so it was terribly important. And I think Americans can feel good about that and say, wow, that was a moment. We stepped up, manned up, some would say. We stepped into a role that was an important role at that time. We're very fortunate to have a very stable world system. ISIS is not going to bring down Great Britain or Germany or France or Russia. It will be a big nuisance, and it will break many hearts. But it's not going to destabilize the entire world system, despite what some people say. We're not going to see this happening in St. Louis, Missouri, or any such thing. And the thing is that those kinds of threats are mostly policing matters. They really are about policing. And we couldn't have stopped 9/11 with a bigger army. Right? So we have to think, what's the problem, and what's the solution for that problem? Not what's the solution for the problem of 1947.
That's a perfect way to end a very, very great talk. Thank you very, very much. And so ends another event in the 112-year history of the Commonwealth Club of California. Thank you very much.